Our sermon passage this morning is from the book of Matthew. Matthew's in the New Testament, and it's the first book of the New Testament. We're in chapter 16, verses 1 through 20. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. And he answered them, "When it is evening, you say, 'It'll be fair weather, for the sky is red.' And in the morning, 'It'll be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening.' You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah." So he left them and departed. When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. And Jesus said to them, "Watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, "We brought no bread." But Jesus, aware of this, said, "O you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How is it that you fail to understand that I did not speak about bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not yet revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." And then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ.
Thank you, Nikki. Well, we continue our sermon series in the book of Matthew, and as we do, we come to what's really the climax of the entire first half of the book of Matthew, that starting next week in verse 21 of chapter 16, really through the rest of the book, it's Jesus making his way to Jerusalem, where he's going to be killed and die on a cross. And so this chapter here, and the passage we're going to be looking at this morning then, is really the climax of the entire first half of the book of Matthew, the first half of this narrative of Matthew that we've begun to see all the way from chapter 1, all the way through chapter 16, verse 20 here. And this climax, this climactic point of the book, this passage here, can merely be summarized in this climactic question that Jesus asked there in verse 15. "Who do you say that I am?" That question is the question that the whole book of Matthew has been answering up to this point. If you go all the way back, starting with Jesus' genealogy, then into his birth narrative, then into Jesus' baptism, and then to Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, to a sermon on the mount, and all the miracles, and all the healings, and all the parables that he taught. All of these things were meant to answer that climactic question in chapter 16, verse 15, "Who do you say that I am?" or "Who is Jesus?" And that question then is the most important question any of us here in this room and anybody who has ever lived on the entire face of this earth will ever answer in their lives. Who do you say that Jesus is? Like, your answer to that question will first and foremost determine your eternal destiny. It will determine what's going to happen to you after you die and you're no longer on this earth. Your answer to that one question will determine your eternal destiny. And not only that, but your answer to that question will also determine how you respond when you get a really scary diagnosis from the doctor. Your answer to that question will determine how you respond when you get laid off from your job. Your answer to that question will determine how you respond when you are in the middle of conflict with your spouse, or when you're enticed by the pleasures of sin, or when you feel lonely and anxious and worried. Like, how you respond in all of those moments and in every moment of your life is going to be ultimately determined by your answer to the question, who do you say that Jesus is? And that's what we're going to see within this passage here this morning. That in this passage, if you notice, we're going to see three different groups of people. And in these three different groups of people, we're going to see who they say Jesus is. We're going to see these three different groups of people and who they believe, who they understand Jesus to be. And not only that, we're going to see how their understanding of who Jesus is, or their lack of understanding of who Jesus is, then practically affects their practical everyday life and how they live and how they respond in circumstances and all of those things. And as we make our way through looking at each of these different groups of people, then I want us to ask the question, which of these groups best describe me? Which of these groups and their understanding of who Jesus is best describes you? And so the first group here we're going to look at is the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And what we're going to see in verses 1 through 4 here is that they still don't understand who Jesus is. They still don't understand who Jesus is. So look at verse 1 with me. Starting in verse 1. Before we get to verse 1, remember where we left off there in chapter 15 of last week. If you remember in chapter 15, we saw Jesus go to the Gentile territory. And if you remember there, he did all these healings and did all these astonishing miracles in the Gentile territory. And then the very last verse of chapter 15, he gets in a boat. And verse 39 of chapter 15 says that he came to the region of Magadan. And the reason that's important is that Magadan is in Jewish territory. And so Jesus is coming back into Jewish territory. And as he comes back into Jewish territory here, in verse 1, look who comes up to him and greets him first. Verse 1. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. And so then I don't know exactly what Jesus does at this point. When these Pharisees and Sadducees come up to him and they ask Jesus for another sign from heaven. If I was Jesus, I would have rolled my eyes and said, you want another sign? Like, what do you think I've been doing the last 15 chapters? I've been giving you sign after sign after sign after sign, which proves and demonstrates that I'm the man from Isaiah that was promised to come from Isaiah chapter 35 in the Old Testament and a bunch of other Old Testament prophecies. I'm the one who was prophesied. I'm the one who's the promised Messiah, the Davidic king that God had promised that was going to come and speak in parables and do all these healings and do all these miracles. Like, I've been showing you sign after sign after sign. It's me. I've shown you enough signs. But as we've seen throughout, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and so many of the other religious leaders, they were blind to all these signs. And they didn't understand that all of these signs ultimately pointed to the fact that this was Jesus, or this was the promised Davidic king that God had promised from the Old Testament. Instead, in chapter 12, if you remember, the Pharisees, when they saw the signs that Jesus performed, they believed that it didn't demonstrate and prove that Jesus was the Davidic king that God had promised. They believed that these were signs that he was doing all these things through the power of Satan. Again, they were blind. They had seen all of these signs. He's provided all of these signs, and they still didn't get it. They were still blind. They still didn't understand. And so look at how Jesus responds then in verse 2 to this request for another sign. Verse 2 says, he answered them, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. See what Jesus is saying here? He's saying to the Pharisees and Sadducees, he's saying, you guys are really good meteorologists. Like, you all are great at predicting the weather. You're able to look into the sky and see all the signs which explain and determine what weather is about to come. And so you're good at reading and seeing the signs in the skies that forecast the weather that's about to come. But you stink at being able to interpret the signs of the times. What he means by that phrase, the signs of the times, it's a reference to the signs that point to the fact that the Messiah that God had promised is here. And they've seen all these signs and they miss it. They're great meteorologists, but they're horrible at reading the signs of the times that demonstrate who the Messiah is, because he's standing smack dab right in front of them. Look then at what he tells them in verse 4. He calls them, he says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. And so he left them and departed. In other words, what Jesus is getting at here is that I've given you a billion signs. I've given you so many signs that point to the fact of who I am. You should know who I am. You've seen all the signs. And so I'm only going to give you one more sign then. You want a sign? I'll give you one more. Not right now, though. Instead, the sign I'm going to give you, the only sign I'm going to give you that's left, is what he calls the sign of Jonah, which is code for his resurrection. That just as Jonah was in the belly of a great fish for 3 days and 3 nights before he was spit out, so Jesus is going to be dead in the grave for 3 days and 3 nights before he's resurrected from the dead. But as we'll see at the very end of the book of Matthew, even when the Pharisees and Sadducees see the sign of Jonah, even when they see this final miracle of all miracles, signs that point to the fact that Jesus is the Davidic king, they're going to try and cover it up. And they're not going to believe and understand who Jesus is. And so then let's pause here and try and apply this. Like, I wonder if this group right here describes anybody here this morning. That much like the Pharisees and the Sadducees here, you've heard. You have heard, you have read about all these signs that Jesus has done, all these miracles, all these healings, all these signs which demonstrate that prove that Jesus is the messianic king of David that God had promised. You've heard all the stories and the prophecies in the Old Testament that point forward to Jesus. You've heard about all of his miracles and all of his healings. You've heard and read about all of his teachings and all of his parables. You've heard about his death on the cross. You've even heard and read about and listened to the fact of the sign of Jonah and how Jesus was resurrected and how Jesus was raised from the dead after 3 days in the grave. But after reading and listening and hearing about all of those signs that Jesus has given, you still don't believe. You're still skeptical. You're still not convinced that Jesus is who he said that he was. You still don't understand and believe that Jesus is the promised Messiah King that God had promised to come. If that's you this morning, then C.S. Lewis reminds you that you only have three options when it comes to who Jesus is. Only three options, not four, not five. Like, you only have three options. Number one, Jesus is either a bold-faced liar who knew that he wasn't the promised Messiah, but he went around trying to act like he was and convince everybody else that he was, and therefore is a bold-faced liar. That's option number one. Option number two is that he's a crazy lunatic, meaning he thought he was the promised Messiah, and he went around acting like he was the promised Messiah, but in reality, he wasn't. He was just delusional, crazy, out of his mind. That's option number three, number two. Option number three, then, is that he is who he said he was, and that he is, in fact, the promised Messiah King that God had promised. And so then those are the only three options that you really have when it comes to who Jesus is. That's all you have. And the reason that C.S. Lewis says that these are the only options that you have is because you can't make the claims that Jesus made about himself and then just say, oh, he's just a good person. Like, you can't read the claims that Jesus made about himself and then just say, oh, he was just a good religious teacher. You can't read the claims that Jesus made about himself and just say, oh, he's just some enlightened religious leader. Uh-uh. Those aren't categories. Those aren't options on the table when it comes to who Jesus is if you claim the things that Jesus claimed. Instead, if you made the claims that Jesus made, then you're only left with three options when it comes to Jesus. He's either a bold-faced liar, he's either a crazy lunatic, or he is who he said that he was. He is the promised Messiah King that God had promised to come. Those are the options that you have. So that's the first response that we see in the first group, and how they respond to who Jesus is in this passage. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, they don't understand who Jesus is. In verses 5 through 12 then, we're going to see the next response to who Jesus is. And in verses 5 through 12, we're going to see that the disciples forget and don't remember who Jesus is. They forget and don't remember who Jesus is. That's what we see starting there in verse 5. Look at verse 5 with me. Verse 5 says, when the disciples reached the other side, talking about the other side of the sea, they had forgotten to bring any bread. And so Jesus said to them, watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, we brought no bread. So this is kind of funny here. Like, this is meant to be kind of funny here, okay? About what's going on here, the misunderstanding of the disciples here. Jesus warns his disciples about the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And when the disciples hear the word leaven, they immediately think that Jesus is talking about literal bread. And they begin to look around and they're like, ah, we forgot the bread. And they begin to freak out. They begin to panic. They begin to worry. And so then look what Jesus says to them there in verse 8. But Jesus, aware of this, said, oh, you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive, or that word could also be translated as understand, do you not yet understand? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered, or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? So Jesus here, he's gently, I believe, rebuking the disciples. And he's rebuking them for their little faith, that their faith has grown small, it's grown to be little. Which makes sense, right? His rebuke makes sense, right? Like, think about what they've seen over the last 2 chapters. They've seen, number one, Jesus take 5 loaves and feed 5,000 people. Then in chapter 15, they saw Jesus take 7 loaves and feed 4,000. So they saw all that, like, not too long ago. And now they're in this boat. They go to the other side of the sea. And after seeing Jesus do all of that, this miracle bread maker, provide all this bread for all these thousands of people, now they're getting all anxious and worried, and they're freaking out because they're looking around and they're like, we don't have any bread. When this miracle bread maker that they saw just moments earlier produce miraculously all this bread, right smack dab in front of them, they're all worried that they're going to go without bread. But instead of getting all worried and anxious, like, where's the bread? Are we going to eat? How are we going to be provided for? Where's the bread? They should have remembered. It's the key word. They should have remembered what Jesus had done in the past, what they had already seen Jesus do, and therefore trust that he'd do the same thing again. And that's the key word here in verse 9. It's Jesus asked his disciples, do you not remember? And then look at how this little episode ends there in verse 11 and 12. Jesus asked his disciples, how is it that you fail to understand that I didn't even speak to you about bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. In other words, Jesus is saying, hey guys, I wouldn't even talk about real leaven. I wouldn't even talk about real bread. I was using that figuratively to describe the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and its corrupting influence, and to beware of that and to be watchful of that. And so think about this story we just saw here. I don't know about you, but this story is like a mirror for me in my life in so many instances. But this story here, it's a picture of us as Christians. So many times, isn't it? That as Christians, it's easy to remember who Jesus is, what Jesus has done, like in a setting like this. Like when we gather together on Sunday morning and we sing and we pray and we open up the Word. It's easy to remember what Jesus has done. It's easy to remember who Jesus is. It's easy to remember what Jesus has promised to do. But what about when work begins to get really stressful? Or what about when parenting begins to feel really just overwhelming? Or what about when you're single and you really want to get married? Or what about when you just feel left out and lonely and insecure and... What about those moments? In those moments, do you remember who Jesus is? Like in those moments, do you remember what Jesus has done? In those moments, do you remember what Jesus has promised to do? In those moments, when you don't have any bread? Or do you forget? Do you have some amnesia? And because you forget who Jesus is, what he's done, what he's promised to do, you just kind of forget in those moments, and therefore your faith begins to get really little and small. Oh, you have little faith. You get anxious and scared and all those things like the disciples here. If that's you this morning, then the next time you begin to worry, the next time you begin to worry and maybe grow anxious about your finances, you begin to worry, how am I going to make it? Then remember. Remember who Jesus is. Remember what he's done. Remember what he's promised to do. Remember Matthew 6:30 when Jesus says, but if God so clothes the great grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown in the oven, will he not much more clothe you? Or the next time you begin to feel weak and exhausted and just insecure and just weighing over your head, then remember 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, which says, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Oh, how often we forget who Jesus is and what he's done in those moments in our lives in which we don't have any bread. Work is overwhelming. Parenting is overwhelming. Life is overwhelming. And we don't remember, we forget who he is and what he's done. Like the primary way we fight our little bitty faith in those moments is by remembering. Is by remembering. And this book right here gives us a whole lot of material to remember of who Jesus is, what he's done, and what he will do. Which then leads to this third and final response here to who Jesus is. And that's the response of Peter here in verses 13 through 20. And in these verses, what we're going to see is that Peter here, unlike the Pharisees and the Sadducees who still don't understand who Jesus is, unlike the disciples that we just saw who forget and don't remember who Jesus is, we're going to see Peter here declare and confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. He understands. He knows who Jesus is. So what Matthew writes, look at verse 13 there of chapter 16. Matthew writes, "Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, 'Who do people say that the Son of Man is?' And they said, 'Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets.'" And so in verse 13 here, what we see is that Jesus, again, changes locations along with his disciples. And this time he travels to this district known as Caesarea Philippi, which is far north, kind of furthest north area part of Israel here. And there's a whole lot we could get into the background of this location, but we don't have time. But Jesus comes in and he asks his disciples who everybody thinks that he is. Who do people say that the Son of Man is? And he asked his disciples, like, what's the opinion of people? Who do they say that I am? So the disciples begin to say, tell him, they begin to say, some people say that you're John the Baptist. Some people say that you're the Old Testament prophet Elijah. Other people say you're the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah. And other people say you're one of the other prophets that have returned. So that's who the people are saying that Jesus is. In verse 15 then, Jesus takes the question that he asked his disciples and he turns it around on them. And he asks them, okay, that's who people say that I am, but what about you, disciples? In verse 15, he asks them, who do you say that I am? And in verse 16 then, Simon Peter steps up. And he speaks up, and he serves as a spokesperson for the disciples, and he answers Jesus' question here. And look at his answer in verse 16. He declares, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." So it's important to understand this confession that Peter's making here. He declares and confesses first that Jesus is the Christ. What's important to note about that is that Christ is not Jesus' last name. Everybody with me? So Jesus Christ, John Crawford, Crawford is my last name. Christ is not Jesus' last name. Christ is a title that literally means anointed one. It's the Hebrew word Messiah. It's a reference to kings. They were the anointed one of God. And it's specifically a reference to the promised Davidic king, the Messiah, the anointed king that God had promised that was going to come from the line of David and establish his kingdom and his reign and his rule here on earth that would last forever. So Peter's declaring that Christ is Jesus. Then he also says, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And that's really, really important here too. Usually, when we read in the Bible this title here, Son of God, we usually read that and simply think that it's referring to Jesus as deity. We usually read that and think it's a reference to the Trinity, that it's a reference to the fact that Jesus is the Son of the Father. And all of that is true. All of that is part of what it means for Jesus to be the Son of God. At the same time, though, it means a whole lot more than just that. Instead, this title, Son of God, is also a messianic title. And this title, Son of God, comes from places in the Old Testament, like 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 14, and Psalm chapter 2, verse 7. And specifically when it comes to 2 Samuel chapter 7, if you remember there, God is making a covenant. The Davidic covenant. He's making a covenant with King David. And in that covenant, God promises David that after David croaks and dies, that one of his sons, he's going to have all these sons, but one of his sons is going to reign as king forever, and that his kingdom is going to have no end. And in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 14, God says this about David's son that is going to have an eternal kingdom and reign forever. God says, I will be to him, talking about David's son, a father, and he will be to me a son. If you go to 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 7, the Davidic king that is to come is also called God's son. So put all that together. That's what Peter is declaring here. He's declaring what the genealogy all the way back in Matthew chapter 1, and what the birth narrative all the way back in chapter 2, and what the baptism of Jesus all the way back in chapter 3, and what the testing in the wilderness of Jesus in chapter 4, and what the Sermon on the Mount in chapters 5 through 7, and what all the miracles and all the healings and all the parables were meant to demonstrate and prove. Namely, that Jesus is none other than the Christ, the Son of the living God. He's the Davidic king that God had promised. And so the Pharisees and the Sadducees don't understand this. The people that have been polled, and they don't understand this. The disciples at times forget this and don't remember this. But Peter declares and confesses that this is who Jesus is. It's the high point that all of the first half of the book of Matthew is pointing to, is that question and is that confession. It's the exclamation point that all the stories that we've seen and genealogies we've seen up to this point were meant to demonstrate and prove. Peter proclaims it boldly and courageously from his own lips. In verses 17 through 20 then, what Jesus is going to do is he's going to give us three really important truths then. When it comes to this confession, three important truths about this confession that Peter just made here about Jesus. And the first truth that he tells us about this confession that Peter just made is this, is that this confession that Peter made, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, was divinely revealed to Peter. It was divinely revealed to Peter. In other words, just think about this. How did Peter know who Jesus was and the Pharisees and the Sadducees didn't? How did Peter know who Jesus was and all these other people didn't? Was Peter just smarter than everyone else? Was Peter just a lot more perceptive? Was he just more insightful than everybody else? Uh-uh. That's not why Peter understood who Jesus was. Instead, Jesus tells us why Peter understood who Jesus was and why other people didn't. Look at verse 17. And Jesus answered him, talking about Peter, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." Bar-Jonah simply means son of Jonah. "For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." You see what he's saying here? This is why Peter understood who Jesus was and others didn't. It wasn't because Peter was smarter than everyone else. It wasn't because flesh and blood, meaning some human, revealed it to Peter and explained to Peter who Jesus was. Instead, the only reason that Peter understood who Jesus was is because God revealed it to him. That's the only reason. Which means if God hadn't revealed that to Peter, then Peter wouldn't have known. Peter would have been blind just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He'd be in the same boat. He wouldn't understand who Jesus was. He wouldn't be able to make that confession. He'd be out in the dark just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But he did understand. Not because of some human, not because of flesh and blood, but because God sovereignly and divinely and graciously gave him eyes to see it and revealed it to him. And the same is true for every single Christian in this room this morning. The reason you understand and know who Jesus is, the reason you see the gospel as the wisdom of God, the reason you see the gospel as being true and beautiful isn't because of your sound logic. And it's not because of your awesome reasoning skills. Instead, the only reason you understand and know and believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, is because God in His sovereign grace revealed it to you. It's the only reason. You didn't figure it out on your own. And the ultimate reason isn't even because somebody taught it to you and explained it to you. Instead, the ultimate reason you understand who Jesus is and what He's done is because God revealed it to you. And when you begin to understand that, the reality of that should humble every Christian in this room. It should remove every ounce of pride, every ounce of feeling of superiority from our hearts, and should cause all of us just to fall on our face and on our knees and praise and worship God the Father for revealing God the Son to us. The second truth then that Jesus teaches about this confession that Peter makes is this. Is that this confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, is the foundation. Is the foundation, or if you want to say, is the rock on which the church is built. So this is what Jesus is going to go on to say in the very next verse, in verse 18. Look there with me at verse 18. Jesus continued to talk to Peter, and He tells Peter this. He says, "And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build My church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." And so then, this is a sermon in and of itself. And we don't have time for just a sermon in and of itself. So I'm going to try and do the best justice I can do when it comes to this specific verse. Important part to understand here is that Jesus here is making a play on words in verse 18 here. Okay, so we're going to bust out just a little bit of Greek. Just hang in there with me. The name Peter is the Greek word petros, which means rock. The word rock, that's translated as the word rock in English in verse 18, is the Greek word petra. Petros and petra. So petros, it's translated as Peter, is the masculine form of the noun rock, while petra is the feminine form of the noun that's translated in English as the word rock there in verse 18. Which then begs the question, okay, what exactly then is this rock that Jesus says He's going to build His church on? As you can imagine, there's been, through the history of the church, all sorts of different interpretations when it comes to that question, and we don't have time to give you exactly every answer that has been given in the history of biblical interpretation of verse 18. Instead, all we have time for is for me to give you my interpretation of verse 18 and my understanding of what this rock is that Jesus says He's going to build His church on. And so that's what I'm going to do. Here's my understanding. I understand this rock to be a reference to the confession that Peter just made in verse 16. Namely, the confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's the rock, that confession, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's the rock that Jesus is going to build His church on. He's going to build His church with those who make the same confession that Peter made here. Meaning those who declare and confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's the confession, that's the truth, that's the declaration that the church is going to be built on. And if that's your confession this morning, then just listen to the staggering promise that Jesus gives to you and that Jesus gives to all of us, this church, Christians making up this church, at the end of verse 18. He says that the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. It, meaning the church, meaning all those who confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, that make up the church. If that's you, if that's us, Jesus promises that the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church, against us. Again, if you are one of those confessors, then the gates of hell shall not prevail against you and against us, the church. So then, again, what in the world does that mean? Well, the word here that's translated in English in the ESV as hell is the Greek word Hades. And it's a reference to the place of the dead. So not necessarily in this context would we think of this as being hell like we might understand it, but it would be more specifically a reference to like Sheol in the Old Testament. Hades, referring to the realm of the dead, the place of the dead. And so there's a whole lot of different views and interpretations when it comes to this Peter's or Jesus's reference to the gates here. The gates of Hades, the gates of the dead. But however we understand this imagery of gates here, Jesus is still making the same point here. And his point is this. It's that death won't prevail and triumph over the church. That death won't prevail and triumph over all those who have confessed that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Why? Because death didn't triumph over Jesus. It's where all of Matthew's ultimately headed. Instead, as we'll see in the chapters to come, Jesus is going to die. He's going to die on a cross. Like, spoiler alert. He's going to die on a cross at the end of this narrative, at the end of the story, in the place of sinners, for all those who would ever trust him, place their faith in him. But we're going to see that the gates of death aren't going to prevail and triumph over Jesus. Instead, at the end of Matthew, we're going to see that 3 days later, after Jesus died, he was raised back from the dead, and he triumphed over death. And therefore, since death couldn't triumph over Jesus, then death isn't going to triumph over his church. Instead, the Bible promises that one day, Jesus is going to return back to this earth, and when he does, that he's going to raise his church back from the dead, and we're going to live with him forever in a new creation here in this world, known as the new earth. And that reality, that promise right there, is so huge for us to remember this morning. Do you see how practical that promise is for us as Christians? We prayed about this at our prayer gathering last Sunday night, but over the last few months in particular, we've had a number of people within our church diagnosed with all sorts of scary health issues, and particularly different forms of cancer. And so then, do you know how you stare down cancer with confidence? Do you know how you stare down scary health diagnosis with confidence? You do it by remembering that the gates of Hades, the gates of death, will not triumph and prevail against the church. You do it by remembering that if you've confessed that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, then that death won't triumph over you. Not only that, but mentioned this last week as well. We have a slew of people within our church who are interested in being sent as missionaries. And some of y'all, want to go to some really dangerous places. And so then how do you take the gospel to dangerous places who don't want you there and who could kill you? How do you do that? You do it because you know that if you've confessed that Jesus Christ is Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, then death won't triumph over you. That even if they kill you, death won't triumph over you. And so then this is what Jesus is teaching here. He's teaching here that the church and all those who make up the church are invincible. That nothing and no one can destroy it and prevail against us. Not even death. Which then leads to this third and final truth, and we're going to rush through this one, but about this confession that Peter made. And that's that this confession is the means by which Peter and the church have authority to exercise the keys of the kingdom. So this is what Jesus is going to go on to say in verse 19 here. Look at verse 19. He tells Peter, I will give you, and the you here is singular, referring to Peter, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. So then I'll be the first to admit, get to verse 19 here. Like again, that's a really, really hard verse. And hard to make sense of and exactly what Jesus is referring to here and all that. But again, here's my understanding of verse 19 here. That Jesus says here that he's going to give Peter the keys to the kingdom of heaven, which will then give Peter the authority to bind and loose here on earth. That's what he says there in verse 19. So then what in the world does that mean? Well, the word bind here has the idea of prohibiting or forbidding something. And loosing here has the idea of permitting or allowing something. And so then as the one who has been given the keys of the kingdom, Peter then would have the authority to make decisions and render judgments on what's prohibited and what's permitted in God's kingdom. In saying that though, and this is really important, these judgments and decisions that he makes aren't his own. As if whatever Peter prohibits and whatever Peter permits on earth will then become prohibited and permitted in heaven. As if Peter's judgments enact that or make those happen. Instead, according to the grammar here in verse 19, Peter is simply prohibiting or permitting on earth that which has already been permitted or prohibited by God in heaven. Or another way to say it is he's simply relaying decisions and judgments that have already been made by God in heaven. Decisions and judgments like what is sin and what is not sin. Decisions and judgments like what is a true gospel and what is a false gospel. Decisions and judgments like what is a true confession of faith and what is not a false confession of faith. Decisions and judgments like what is a true Christian, what is a false Christian. What is a true teacher, what is a false teacher. The Peter has been given, and I believe the rest of the disciples, as we'll see later on in the book of Acts, the authority to render such judgments here on earth, not based upon their own authority, or rendering judgments that make those to be true somehow in their own authority, but based upon the authority of what's been prohibited and permitted already by God in his kingdom. And the apostles and Peter then simply have the authority to enact that and to relay that and render those judgments on earth that have already been rendered in heaven. What's interesting is that when we get to chapter 18 in Matthew, so just a couple more chapters, we're going to see that Peter isn't the only one who's been given these keys of the kingdom and the authority to render such judgments. Instead, we're going to see that we, the church, meaning those who have made the same confession that Peter's made, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, has been given the keys of the kingdom of heaven to render such judgments as well. And in chapter 18, what we're going to see is that we're to exercise these keys of the kingdom and render such judgments on things like church discipline and church membership and ensuring sound doctrine among us and sound teachers and making sure that the right gospel is preached in our church. Which, if you think about it, it's not just the pastors or elders or Peter's or the apostles' responsibility. It's your responsibility. As a member of this church and as one who's made this confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. It's the responsibility of all those who confessed and make that their confession. So then, who do you say that Jesus is? Who do you say that Jesus is? That's the climactic question. that these first 15 and a half chapters, 16 chapters in Matthew have been leading to. This is the question, climactic question, that everything we've seen up to this point in Matthew has been answering for us. That after everything we've seen up to this point in Matthew, we get to this question, this climactic point, and Jesus isn't just asking this question to his disciples, he's asking that question to us, the reader of Matthew. Who do you say that Jesus is? If you're here this morning, you're still unsure. If you're here this morning, you still don't understand. If you're still skeptical, you're still not convinced that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, then I'm praying that maybe even today, maybe through the preaching of God's word, that God would sovereignly and graciously cause your blind eyes to see and to behold the glory of Jesus and what he's done in his life and his death and his resurrection, and that you would unashamedly declare, like Peter, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. But for those of us who have already made that confession, then I pray that you would leave here feeling three things. First, I pray that you would leave here feeling humbled. Humbled. Knowing that the only reason that this is your confession and that you understand this and this is your confession is because God has graciously revealed it to you. Secondly, I pray that you would leave here feeling confident. Confident. Knowing that the church that has been built on this confession, that not even death can triumph over it. Not even death can prevail against it. And third and finally, I pray that you would leave here feeling a deep sense of responsibility. We'll talk more about this in Matthew chapter 18. But a deep sense of responsibility, because if you've made this confession and belong to the church, then the keys of the kingdom and the authority to render on earth the judgments that God has already rendered in heaven have been given to you. Have been given to the church and all those who make that same confession. Who do you say that Jesus is? Feel humbled, feel confident, and feel a sense of responsibility. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this day. Thank you for your word. And even for all that we've seen in the book of Matthew up to this point, leading to this climactic question and this climactic confession. And so, God, I pray that even as we're coming face to face with this confession once again, I pray that we would be in awe and just in wonder when it comes to the reality of this confession, that we understand it, first of all, the promises associated with it, and what this means for us in our everyday lives. Oh God, thank you that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.